This episode of the Sleep Apnea Stories podcast is sponsored by Aeroflow Sleep. Aeroflow Sleep is the nation's fastest growing durable medical equipment company, supplying CPAP machines, masks, and accessories to sleep apnea patients with eligible insurance plans. Not only do they conveniently ship CPAP supplies right to your door, Aeroflow Sleep takes it upon themselves to navigate the complexities of the insurance process. They speak to your doctor on your behalf so you can be confident in the treatment and coverage you receive without lifting a finger. If you're due for replacement parts, Aeroflow Sleep takes care of that too. They inform you exactly what's needed and when through a state-of-the-art online patient portal or via your preferred method of contact. I learned about Aeroflow Sleep 3 years ago, and I now support them as their patient advocacy expert. And what I love is that they're not just providing you with a product. They're genuine people. They're ready to serve you and looking to put the care back into healthcare. To learn more, visit their website at aeroflowsleep.com. That's A-E-R-O-F-L-O-W sleep.com. And learn more about Aeroflow Sleep today. On this podcast, we discuss medical diagnoses and procedures. All of the guests express their own opinions. You should always seek medical advice from a trained and credentialed professional when making decisions about your own health. Welcome to the Sleep Apnea Stories podcast. I'm Emma Cooksey, and I've been coping with sleep apnea since childhood. I didn't know anyone in my life with a sleep disorder, so I decided to start this podcast. I'm here to build community and provide a platform for people with sleep apnea to tell their stories. Together, we can shatter stereotypes and raise awareness. We'll be exploring all sorts of treatment options and lifestyle choices to help you live your best life with sleep apnea. This is Sleep Apnea Stories, and I'm so glad you're here. It's Emma Cooksey here, and I'm your host. So even if I do say so myself, this episode today is so good, and I feel like it's a must listen for any parent who is trying to get answers about their kids' sleep. It's so inspiring and just would really encourage you to keep going and keep asking questions if you think there's a problem. So today's guest is Nathan Pounds, and Nathan is a registered respiratory therapist, registered pulmonary function technologist, and certified asthma educator. He's in Springfield, Missouri, and he and his wife, Nicole, have 4 children, aged 9, 8, 4, and 1. The 2 oldest were adopted through the foster care system. Both adopted children have special needs and have required specialized medical care throughout their lives. Their oldest in particular has faced numerous pulmonary issues, including asthma, chronic respiratory infections, and obstructive sleep apnea. Nathan is driven by a desire to help parents and families become the best advocates for themselves and their loved ones. And boy, did he have to advocate. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Nathan Pounds. Thank you so much for joining me.
I'm excited to be here. Thank you, Emma.
Do you want to just start by setting the scene of your family, what the makeup of your family is, whereabouts in the country you are, just give people some background.
Yeah, of course. So my name is Nathan Pounds. I am a registered respiratory therapist. I teach in respiratory therapy at Ozarks Technical Community College in Springfield, Missouri. My wife is a speech-language pathologist. She works for a telehealth company, and we have 4 children. Our 2 oldest are foster and adopted. They are half brothers. And then we have 2 biological children, and they are 9, 8, 4, and 1. And so, you know, we keep it hopping in our house.
That's one way to put it. I have 2, so I'm kind of like trying to imagine the chaos of 4, but I don't know. You probably have it much more organized than we do.
When you're outnumbered, you do what you can. So. Yeah.
When did this whole thing of sleep just come up? When did you notice anything and start thinking that it was an issue?
So interestingly enough, when our oldest came to live with us, he was 2 days old. 2 days old, I got him from the foster care agency, and he immediately went apneic.
Oh, wow.
Turned blue, little cyanotic baby. We went right back to the hospital. And this was pre my respiratory therapy days. That's actually where I was introduced to respiratory therapy. But for him, he ended up having multiple pulmonary issues. He had pneumonia several times, other issues. He's only got one kidney, some different facial structure abnormalities when he was first born. I forget what it's called right now, but his forehead was actually touching his nose. They were worried about his brain being deformed because of the shape of his skull. And that's where they actually found like his kidney. And then we had these issues breathing. And then, you know, we fast forward and he ends up with asthma. He's got atopic confirmed through pulmonary function testing, asthma and allergy testing. So this little guy's always had some issues with breathing. And then at age one, he was diagnosed failure to thrive. So little guy, wouldn't eat for days. And so he's got this kind of combo between pulmonary history. He's small, he's not gaining weight. And when he becomes two, we start to notice this, like, man, he is wiggly. He is high energy. He moves and wiggles and bounces. And, you know, we just thought that was toddler. That was what toddlers do. It was our first child too. And
so I actually don't know a lot about what they do with newborns and mm-hmm. really small children. So when you were noticing the apneic events and him stopping breathing as a baby, what do they do at that point?
Oh, so at that point, you know, they did like a sternal rub. They put some CPAP on him in the hospital to try to give him some of that support. And then he was on oxygen. He never ended up being intubated. He never ended up being on a mechanical ventilator, but
so he
did
have breathing
on
his own.
Yes. He did have some of that non-invasive support to try to like, hey, buddy, this is how we do this. And I know that more now looking back at what happened, but that's kind of what they were doing at that point was, hey, this is how we're breathing.
And you know, so sorry, he was kind of two and wiggly.
Yes. So he's two and wiggly. He's high energy. He's high sensory seeking. He's like crashing, bouncing, jumping all over everything all the time. And then he starts getting to that age, you know, that two, three, he's starting to put his clothes on. We're working through that. And he's struggling with that stuff. He's
sensory, yes, like no tags or
some of that
scratchiness,
but also like the executive functioning skills of it. He's putting his pants on like inside out, shirts on backwards. And okay, two or three, that's okay. Again, we kind of move forward and we're starting to get into like 5, 6 years old. We're still doing the same stuff.
Yeah.
He's coming out for school with his pants inside out and backwards, jeans. Yeah. And you're like, man, what is going on? But whenever we start talking about what is obviously present to us at that, we're thinking ADHD possibly.
Yes.
High energy, executive functioning skills are struggling. You know, he has to be reminded lots of times. He has lots of accidents. He's spilling things all over the place. And so we're asking, maybe at this like kindergarten, first grade mark, we were asking, should we get him ADHD testing? But he wasn't having behavioral problems. He didn't have behavioral problems. So the PCP's like, nah, we're not going to do ADHD testing. Well, he continues to have these issues as he goes along. And interestingly enough, my wife runs a podcast for her company.
Oh.
And so she's an SLP, and she was doing a podcast with a SLP and an orofacial myologist, which I'm sure your listeners are very familiar with.
Yes.
But she was talking with this orofacial myologist about the different structures and how these structures will mess with sleep. And then she offhandedly said that many children with sleep disturbances are often misdiagnosed with ADHD, or at least neglecting the sleep side of those things because they can look very similar. Symptoms like fatigue, irritability, difficulty paying attention, agitation, impulsive behavior, excitability, inability to sit still, forgetfulness, problems listening, difficulty playing quietly, difficulty.
And I feel like that's counterintuitive often because we look at adults with sleep problems and they can't stay awake and they're sleepy.
Yes.
Whereas I think so many children we're realizing show up with more of these like hyperactivity type behaviors.
Yes.
And from a sleep problem, which doesn't seem to make sense for a lot of people, but like sure is the thing.
Because they're like fighting to stay awake.
Yeah.
And in that fight to stay awake and that fight to move, they're all over the place. They're dysregulated. And so this SLP that my wife is interviewing.
So for people listening, that language pathologist.
Speech language pathologist.
Worries. Yeah.
She advocates that before we start medicating children with these ADHD symptoms, especially these early elementary kids, that we really should be working to rule out sleep disturbances first. Because why wouldn't we rule out a sleep disturbance before we start someone on a child on a medication?
Yes.
And so that's where we ended up going, okay, well, maybe we'll ask for a sleep study. And, you know, at that point, because of his needs, because we're seeing his things, and the same thing with his younger brother, who's just a little bit younger than 11 months than him, he has some needs as well. We had like a tight sleep schedule. We had a clean sleep schedule, no screens 2 hours before bed, family reading before bed, no sugary foods within a couple hours of bed, blackout curtains in the room, noise machine, same bedtime. So I was like, this is how we're going to work through this. These kids need routine. Yeah. And we could have a whole different conversation on kids with like a trauma background and all that stuff. Cause that's where we were thinking is like, these kids are coming from foster care and all of this stuff. So we need to set this stuff in place, not really thinking at the beginning that like they need this for their sleep.
Right.
They need this for sleep.
But for consistency and for reliability and just knowing that that's what's happening every day.
Yes. And as you know, we're learning more and more about clean sleep habits, about removing the blue light stimulation, about the consistent bedtimes, about food, you know, not eating right before bed and eating clean foods and all of that stuff. But at this point, we've got this sleep routine down and we're going to start advocating for a sleep study.
Are you a new or struggling CPAP user? Are you waking up and flinging your CPAP mask across the room in frustration? Maybe you have mask leaks, skin irritation, or wake up with a dry mouth. You might be dealing with uncomfortable trapped gas from swallowing air or hair breakage from your headgear. If any of this sounds familiar, you're not alone, and I wrote a workbook just for you. The 6-week CPAP Solutions Workbook is out now and has been designed to give you solutions to all the most common CPAP problems. Visit sleepapneastories.com to order now. That's sleepapneastories.com. Did you know, so at this point, I'm really interested to know, did you realize that that was going to involve advocating, or did you think you were just going to go to the doctor and ask for a sleep study?
I thought we would just go to the doctor and ask for a sleep study.
Yeah.
And so we went to the doctor and said, hey, we've got this great information. We think our kid needs a sleep study. And they said, no.
Right.
They said,
what did they tell you?
They said, is he snoring?
Oh, right.
Is he snoring? And we said, no. So because we'd been logging, we'd been paying really close attention. So for him, he would like bounce in bed. He would wake up drenched in sweat. Yes. It would take him an hour or two to get to sleep. He would wake up multiple times in the night. It'd be really hard to get him back to sleep. In the morning, it'd be hard to get him out of bed. Then he'd be so grouchy. He'd be non-compliant. And these things were progressing worse as he was getting older. And so we're like, we've got this great information. Here's this data. Boom, let's get a sleep study. And we got told, no, he's not snoring. And is he having behavioral problems at school? We're like, well, define a behavioral problem for us, because he's not living his best life. He's not doing his greatest. He's not, you know, in school suspension or getting called but he could still, you know, benefit from ruling this out possibly.
Right.
We got told no. So we continue to monitor, continue to have issues.
How did you feel when they said no?
Frustrated. You know, this is a kid that we had had, we've seen every specialist under the sun, it feels like, for something different. Endocrinology, nephrology, neurology, you know, we sleep now. We've seen all of this stuff and we've had so many like barriers. And then we're like, oh, maybe this is a thing that can help him. And we get told no for the reason that he's not snoring. He's not snoring.
Which just a reminder for everybody listening that you definitely don't need to snore to have sleep apnea. And that goes for adults as well. Like, we just got into this big discussion about this recently where oftentimes a lot of the messaging about sleep apnea is, you know, stop the snore or, like, you know, look out for loud snoring, when a lot of people that is present with adults, but it's less common in children. And children, you know, can have sleep apnea and not be snoring for sure.
Yes.
So let everybody listening hear that.
Well, and something else to mention is he didn't pass the eye test. He didn't pass the eye test because he's not obese. He's not large. He's small. Nice. He's underweight.
Yes.
And so they're like, they're looking at his PCPs, looking at him going, you're not snoring. You're not a big kid. It's probably behavior.
Because as a reminder, the primary care physicians in this country don't receive enough training in sleep. Mm-hmm. So a lot of them are still looking for only obese patients who are snoring loudly. And we see sleep apnea in so many other populations than that, that it's, mm-hmm. it's disappointing for sure and frustrating, as you mentioned. So what was your next thing?
So the next thing was kind of the squeaky wheel gets the grease, right?
Yeah.
We're continuing to monitor him. And so we just continue to ask. We asked, I think, two more times just to consider it. Like, what's it going to hurt? What's it going to hurt? Even that's the attitude we ended up taking about it, is like, what's it going to hurt to do this sleep study on him?
Right.
It's not really an invasive procedure. Yeah, it's uncomfortable maybe for him. He's sleeping in a different area. He's got all the electrodes.
Why, for one night.
For one night.
To try and get some answers.
What's it going
to
hurt?
Yeah.
And so they do it. The doctor says, okay, all right, I'll refer you over to sleep. And so we go meet with the sleep specialist. And for her, she starts with a blood draw. And we do a blood panel and we find out that he's iron deficient and we learn that he has restless leg syndrome. So he has restless leg syndrome, which totally makes sense. When he gets tired, he vibrated. He just, he couldn't stop moving. He was running. He was crashing. And so we started him on an iron supplement. And in that same visit that we get the iron supplement, to my surprise, we get a sleep study. She goes, okay, we'll do a sleep study. And we do the sleep study.
Because you were expecting her to kind of fob you off.
Yeah.
Because you hadn't got anywhere before.
I kind of expected that. And when she said, we'll do a sleep study, we were like, okay, great. So we'll do this sleep study. And a lot of it was because I feel like I communicated very succinctly. And those hot, kind of those buzzwords of he's getting up multiple times in the night. He's having a hard time going to sleep. He's having a hard time staying asleep. And just really focused in on those things. And I think she heard, I feel like she really heard me. And we got the sleep study. So we do the sleep study. And guess what? He comes back with an AHI of 8.5. An AHI of
8.5. Which for anyone listening who's used to adult measurements of AHI, does that put them in severe? What is that for children?
So that's moderate. So for children, AHI 1 to 5 is mild, 5 to 10 is moderate, greater than 10 is severe. And so he's 8.5. We get referred to ENT. They're like, he's not snoring, but we're going to refer him to ENT anyways. We go, the ENT says he's got a 50-50 shot of these adenoids and tonsils being taken out and it helping. That was a difficult decision for us to make because that surgery is not fun.
Right.
you know.
It's not fun. And I also think that I really wish I knew who said that thing about the only minor surgeries are ones happening to other people's children.
Mm-hmm. Well, and with the adenoids, particularly, the issue is he's on a growth hormone because of that failure to thrive.
Yes. So
he takes daily growth hormone. And there's a risk that those would grow back and we would have to like do this again. And so we ended up taking the risk. We ended up feeling very comfortable with the ENT. We shared our concerns. We're like 50%. That doesn't seem good to yeah. put him through this. Luckily it lined up with his spring break. So he didn't have to miss a whole week of school. We got him out. He does that. And
remind me how old he was at this point.
So he was 8 okay. at this point. So he's 8. He gets his tonsils and adenoids out. And then we get referred to a sleep study for 3 months after that. And so we do it. And also we got a referral to a pulmonologist. I'm going to speak to that for just a second. We got a referral to a pediatric pulmonologist in a larger city further away from here. We don't have a pediatric pulmonologist.
Yeah, there aren't enough of them, no. I would just say. Yeah.
And this pediatric pulmonologist, not to try to trash anybody, I'm sure that they're a fine person. They do good things, but this is the frustrating thing whenever you're dealing with codes and talking with people is he has asthma. He has now confirmed OSA prior to the tonsils and adenoids. And so I want to talk to him about the obstructive sleep issue, the obstructive issues he's having as a whole. He's yeah. having an obstructive disease process with asthma. He's having an obstructive disease process with OSA. Let's talk about this. And he tells me, no, he won't talk about both of them. We can choose one or the other to talk about. So I say, okay, well, we came here to talk about, I guess we'll talk about.
Even though those two things are linked and are to do with how the child is breathing.
And the National Institute of Health even discusses OSA asthma overlap in pediatrics.
Yeah.
But
so is that because of, what was the reasoning behind that? Because of coding?
I was told it was coding.
An insurance thing.
Yep. That so they wouldn't talk about both because they couldn't bill for both. Could only bill for one.
So that's
the only
maddening.
One we're going to talk about. Yes. Well, it gets more interesting because then he goes on to tell me, I was like, well, he wasn't snoring. The only thing to improve a child's sleep apnea is getting the tonsils and adenoids out. That's the only thing that can help. And he goes on to tell me that he thinks it's behavioral, that he's getting up. And I'm not joking you. This was.
He's saying that the fact that your son's getting up at night and being woken from sleep a lot is a behavioral problem.
Yes. And I'm not joking. I hate to say this. And I hate to put any more distrust in the medical system than there can be anyways, but he tells me to lock him in his room. He said, and my son's in the room and he's a very aware 8-year-old. And he yeah. is freaking out. He's like, what? No, you can't lock me in my room. You can't do that. Like, and he told me, he said, well, just having the tonsils, that's the only thing that you can do. There's nothing else that you can do for sleep apnea in children. And
which is demonstrably not true.
It's so wrong. It's so yeah. wrong. We know this is wrong. And
I'm not a medical professional. It doesn't seem like a situation where sleep training was the issue, but there's different ways to talk about evidence-based sleep training versus saying that they're going to advise you to lock a child in their room.
Right.
Like, this doesn't seem like a medical thing to say.
No.
Yeah, that's frustrating.
It definitely felt like we were overstepping medicine and his particular profession into something and trying to say, no, this kid is just kind of hyperactive and you're not doing a good enough job of teaching him how to sleep, which as some parents, as somebody who maybe doesn't advocate well, would make them feel like a really crappy parent and think,
yeah.
well, that's my problem. Well, that's, I'm wrong.
That you had all of the sleep hygiene
yes.
stuff nailed down.
Yes.
And it's not that. You need to treat the sleep apnea, right? Had you done the follow-up sleep study after the 3 months at this point?
We do that sleep study, tonsils and adenoids. 3 months later, we get the follow-up sleep study from the tonsillectomy and adenoidectomy. and his OSA was worse. He was a 12.2. So in children, severe sleep apnea. And what was interesting about it is once we read the report, once we saw it, what happened is he slept better. He was more comfortable with the sleep area. It was the same place and he was more comfortable with it. So he slept a little deeper and his AHI was worse.
Yeah.
It was more. And so then we're on this train of like, okay, let's get him a CPAP. Let's get him a CPAP. And we did. We did within a week. We had him a CPAP.
So the sleep specialist that you were going to do that follow-up sleep study was the one who set him up on CPAP.
Yeah. Okay. So she set him up on CPAP. We were very thankful. I definitely called as soon as that was done. We got the reports and I was like, where can we get a CPAP as quick as possible? Mm-hmm. And she got us set up with one. We had to travel a little bit to go get it because not everybody's got pediatric masks and all this stuff. So we went and got a CPAP and it almost brings tears to my eyes, but he slept on it the first night and he woke up and he smiled. He smiled and said to me, he said, "Dad, I slept so good." And he has been on it for now that was July of last year. So he's been on it for almost a year now. He averages 10 hours a night on the CPAP machine. He feels so much better. He's acting better. You know, he doesn't complain of the daytime tiredness, all of these things. And we're just like in relief because look at what we've done. Look at what
and feeling a huge amount of vindication, yes. I would imagine.
Like, yeah. Oh my gosh, this kid has probably been struggling with his sleep since like day one.
Yes.
And this is the first time in 8.5 years, you know, that he feels good, that he's had a good night's sleep. And for him, he had like plateaued on his growth. And his endocrinologist was like, "Oh, you got a sleep study and you're on a CPAP. Oh, maybe we'll see an increase in his growth." Guess what? We've seen an increase in his growth. He's actually growing.
One of the things I heard somebody speak at a conference recently, and I think that people often don't realize the link between good sleep and growth hormone. Mm-hmm. So how do we fix the system, Nathan? Having been through all this, it seems like it's a lot of different doctor's appointments. It also seems to me, like the more parents I talk to, that going to the ENT is seen as the first thing to do. But then should people go for a sleep study? It seems like in your case, it was really important to get the sleep study.
Yeah, I think for us, we saw all the signs. We had implemented everything we could implement at home. And so it became that advocating piece. It became that piece of, okay, we've done this. This is what we feel like based on evidence. And that's what we have to do. Ironically, I teach a patient education course. And we talk about in this current age, there's more data available to each one of us. And for parents, I feel like it is our responsibility as parents, as family members, to be well educated, to find good research. Now, that's hard for some people, but you need to be looking at the National Institute of Health. Yes. Look at things that Cleveland Clinic puts out, that Mayo puts out, that Children's Colorado, places like that that are reputable sources, that have peer reviews, and read those, make those comments, make those advocating statements to your primary care physicians, because as we all know, that they have 15 minutes with us.
Yes.
They have 15 minutes, and stories and like these beating around the bush thing, they don't have time for it. They don't have the brain power for it.
Yes.
So you've got to say these buzzwords. You've got to find the lingo, which is hard for people to do.
Really hard, but worth it in the end.
Yes. You
have to recognize that primary care physicians especially, I mean, like, they don't have enough training in sleep, and I hope that we change that. But also, they're just not experts in every single thing. And so I think what you said about using the right language is so important to be able to describe exactly what your child is doing while they're sleeping. Mm-hmm. So being really sweaty and tangled up in bedclothes and moving around a whole bunch, I mean, that's not normal sleep,
right?
We have to change that so that people know that normal sleep is children breathing through their noses silently and being still.
Yes.
And if it doesn't look like that, it's worth investigating.
Yes. And if they're in bed for 10 hours, they should wake up most of the time feeling rested, ready to go. They're not being drug out of bed.
Yes.
Like, it's not a fight. That's abnormal.
Yes.
And then those other things, like we talked about, seeing those signs. If you've cleaned up, you know, your sleep stuff and you're seeing these irritability, you're seeing this agitation, you're seeing a lot of these, what are very well known as ADHD symptoms, I would advocate that you should be asking to rule out the sleep disturbance, because why shouldn't we try that as a whole anyways? As a practice in pediatric medicine, why shouldn't we try to rule out a sleep disorder that can be corrected with maybe a CPAP machine or
for
other
some
appliances?
People, a tonsillectomy or whatever it happens to be,
Why wouldn't we try to do that instead of putting kids on stimulants and other drugs first? Maybe they still need it. My son may still need something. He may still have ADHD.
Right.
But we're able to fix his sleep, and that's going to help his body in so many more ways.
So many. Well, listen, Nathan, I really appreciate you taking time to share your story with us. I know it's going to be so helpful for so many parents out there navigating this to feel less alone, especially when they're coming across the frustrating system and feeling like they're not getting anywhere. I hope it will be inspiring for people to listen to.
Well, thank you. And I hope that people feel like they can go out and advocate for themselves and for their families.
Thanks so much for listening. I love hearing from you. If you'd like to be featured in an upcoming episode of the podcast, please email me at sleepapneastories@gmail.com. That's also the place to get in touch if you just want to say hi or ask a question. Alternatively, I'm over on Instagram. My handle there is sleepapneastories. If you're enjoying the podcast, please subscribe or follow, rate and review wherever you listen. This really helps a wider audience find the episodes, and I really appreciate it.